Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call this meeting of the House Special Committee on Tribal Affairs to order. It is now 8:33 a.m. Tuesday, May 7th in Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Tallarico, Representative Lincoln, Representative Ortiz, Representative Vance, and myself, Representative Zelkowski, Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Before we begin, as always, I'd like to thank Julia Bushman, the Secretary from Records, and Doug Bridges from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today. Today, we will be hearing presentations on state and tribal consultation opportunities in Alaska. We'll begin by hearing from Matt Newman, staff attorney at the Native American Rights Fund in Anchorage, followed by Elizabeth Sagalik-Hensley, partner at Landy, Bennett, and Bloomstein Law Offices in Anchorage. Our third presenter will be Natasha Singh, General Counsel at Tanana Chiefs Conference in Fairbanks. And finally, we will hear from the Alaska Federation of Natives Committee for the Advancement of Alaska Natives, Representative Patrick Anderson, who is the Chief Executive Officer for Rural Alaska Community Action Program. So we will begin with Matt Newman. Mr. Newman, are you on the line this morning?
Good morning, and thank you to the Chair for inviting me this morning. My name is Matt Newman. I'm a staff attorney here in the Alaska office of the Native American Rights Fund. NARC is a nonprofit law firm that our Anchorage office serves Alaska's 229 federally recognized tribes, as well as tribal individuals and organizations. And for my presentation this morning to the committee, I was going to give an overview kind of generally of what is government-to-government consultation, what does it mean, where does it, the idea of it come from, and the practicalities of it here in Alaska for the tribes across our state. Starting off just with kind of what is consultation? The word is used a lot, and the idea is discussed a lot, particularly in the area of resource development. But consultation, tribal consultation and government-to-government consultation is not particularly in and of itself a new idea or something that has developed in the recent years. Its origins go back very far in the past, and it stems from the 16 and 1700s law of nations and the expectation that sovereigns, including the newly minted United States in the 1700s, would meet with representatives of other governments to talk about mutual interests and obligations. And that law of nations was made applicable to the United States' relationship with Indian tribes and tribal nations. Some of the first treaties that the United States ever entered into as a newly independent nation were with, not with European nations, but with Native nations. And these early treaties included in their language obligations and commitment by the sovereign that they would consult and meet and negotiate with each other on a government-to-government basis on issues and concerns of mutual interest between the nations. And that concept has evolved over the years and the centuries to now be the modern government-to-government consultation system that we have. And we see it played out in several arenas because it's described and laid out through executive orders, through court decisions, through interagency policies. But the notion of it is not solely federal. As the title implies, it's government to government, and there's no limitation or restriction that that government to government consultation be solely between the federal government and we have many examples where government to government consultation between a tribe and other governments is conducted in all kinds of city government, municipal government throughout Alaska, between the state government, including also international. Take the example, especially on the North Slope, where you have international institutions like the Whaling Commission that involve international meetings between Alaska tribal nations and other representatives. So it's a broad category that reflects again, those origins of mutual interests and issues that require the meeting of government officials. And that's kind of where I want to transition to, you know, what are the practicalities of this? This has a longer history than I think many people realize, but what's the point? Are we just having meetings for the sake of lawyers being able to schedule meetings? Far from it. And consultation in a meaningful sense is a process. It cannot be effective if it's reduced to solely one meeting and handshake. But as an ongoing process of gathering government officials to discuss topics, to identify areas of either concern or agreement, it can result in kind of a best practices model of how policy and decision making, where multiple levels of government or multiple governments are involved, it provides the forum where those governments can discuss and work out those kinds of thorny legal issues. You know, as an attorney, one of my jobs is to sit down and assess and identify risk for my clients and advise as to how to avoid those risks. Consultation really is powerful in doing the same thing. Use resource development kind of as an example. The modern permitting system for a resource development project is exceedingly complex. And it is a mishmash of federal, state, borough ordinances.
Mr. Newman,
yes.
are you perhaps on speakerphone?
I am.
If you wouldn't mind, just for the sound in the room, if it's possible to pick up the handset, that would be helpful.
You have it.
Much better, thank you. Please continue. And for the record, I'd like to recognize that Representative Kopp joined us at 8:35 a.m.
Particularly a legal system like resource development permitting, it's to everyone's mutual benefit to gather and meet and try to identify some of the risky issues or perhaps thorny issues as soon as possible. It's from a risk analysis point of view, having the decision makers or the government policymakers in the room together, having an ongoing dialogue is better for everyone. And it's going to make our admittedly complex system more efficient and work more smoothly. And that's really something unique that really only governments can do. I want to emphasize that I think a common misperception of tribal consultation is that tribes are stakeholders or that their views and interests can be adequately represented in the kind of public comment process, written or oral, that we have. And that perception does not capture or really understand the status of a tribe as a government. And this is why consultation, in my mind, is so critical, is that when dealing with the government, it cannot be the case where a government, whether it's a borough or a city or a tribe or even the state of Alaska, can be dismissed or told, your concerns are yours, and please just write them down and submit them for future review by the agency. I don't think any of us would appreciate the situation in which the Fairbanks North Star Borough was told, the BLM has a project in your region, in your borough. We're not going to meet with you. We're not going to talk with you about this project or its impact on your citizenry. But if you'd like to send us a letter, please do so. I mean, that situation would be unacceptable by any point of view. And the same should be said, and that standard should be universal for all the governments that operate and exist within Alaska, including our 229 tribal governments. They are operating, functioning governments, providing services to their citizenry. And in order for them to represent the interests of their citizenry in any arena or respect, that ability to meet directly, to consult on issues affecting their operations and their people is necessary. And consultation, by and large, is the means and the method that we have developed in our kind of modern legal system, is to provide that avenue for these governments to come together to discuss issues and make it ongoing, because I don't think anyone wants a system in which boxes can be checked and one meeting held. Consultation is an effective medium, it's an effective tool, but it has to be meaningful. And we've seen the results here in the state and across the country. When consultation is done meaningfully, we have better outcomes. And those better outcomes don't just serve the interests of government, they serve the interests of people. And that's what I think all of us are after. That concludes my discussion item here, and I will just at ease for the committee. Thank you.
Are there any questions from committee members? Representative Lincoln.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have a question on just if you could maybe elaborate on some of the risks that you see being mitigated through effective consultation on resource development permitting.
Mm-hmm. You know, one that particularly comes to mind is there are myriad laws and regulations that are applicable to and can be invoked by tribes. And these are laws that go to the evaluation and protection of cultural resources, of tribal subsistence resources, and you know, we'd like to think that a lot of agencies have good attorneys who are familiar with these laws, and they know, oh, we have to comply with the section 221 of AB1 of this act. That often isn't the case. And what I've personally seen in practice is on many issues that happen in the rural parts of the state, in Bush, Alaska, where tribal governments are very familiar with these perhaps unique laws because they live them every day and they have to deal with them every day. Those obscure subsections of a federal law might be an interesting unknown thing to lawyers here in Anchorage, but people in villages are living and breathing and dealing with them every day. And they can provide, and do often provide, those kinds of necessary reminders early in the process, if that consultation occurs, that they can tell folks from the Army Corps of Engineers, for example, hey, there's an issue here, and we need to address it. And the consequences of not addressing it is, I think we've seen time and again, that if a process gets too far down the line and those legal requirements are not dealt with, they're not addressed, well, that can derail everything. That can stop the work and the progress that was made. Consultation is a means and a method to avoid those kinds of situations and outcomes, because government officials were talking, they were dialoguing, they were exchanging information early. That's the kinds of best practices that consultation can achieve.
Mr. Newman, earlier in your statements, you were talking about why in dispelling misperceptions around tribal consultation, why referencing tribes as stakeholders who are reflected in a public comment period process is problematic. Can you tease that out a bit to help at least me better understand how treating tribes as public comment stakeholders is problematic?
It's problematic at the outset because it diminishes the role of what a government is, whether it's a tribal government or a city government or et cetera. A stakeholder is someone who, you know, by definition has stakes or skin in the game, but government and tribal governments are larger than that. They play a more important role than that because tribes are not just operating for their own benefit. They are governments that have a citizenry that they must serve and act on behalf of. And so when a tribe is seeking to participate or to hold a kind of consultation session, they are trying to do so in representing their members, their citizenry. And so if we reduce that work, that representation, down to this government entity that serves a body of people, a body politic, is on the same plane or is treated in kind of the same manner as me here in Anchorage. And we both have the ability to sit at a computer or pick up a pen and write a letter. not a system by which the tribal government is being treated as a government. It's being treated as just a organization, perhaps like the Rotary Club or the Lions Club, and it does not respect the government status that it has. And I, again, draw the analogy of, I don't think anyone would find it acceptable that a city council with an elected mayor and a council would be told or asked, just participate in the regular process or the comment process and fill out a letter. If the city council were to request a meeting with the policymaker at the state level or the federal level, I think that's a situation in which everyone would expect that the city council's request would be honored, because we know that that council is not just individuals who are writing on their own behalf or requesting a meeting on their own behalf. They're working on behalf of the people who elected them. Same is absolutely true for tribal government.
Thank you. Representative Kopp.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Newman, for being here today. Question I have, it seems in the whole task of raising the public knowledge and understanding of what tribal governments are, comes back to our textbooks when they speak of federalism. It's federal, state, and local government and the separation of powers. And there's not really a good discussion of these treaties that you've mentioned that, you know, didn't have expiration dates, and where tribes and nations of Indian people were recognized in that status through treaties. And it seems like a good start would be to have a more of a conscious push to recognize, you know, the federal layer of government, and then the state tribal layer of government, and then local government, because in that whole, you know, education of government and separation of powers, rarely does the subject of tribal powers, as you know, as they are understood within a context of a government, come up. So I guess that's more of an observation that I have seen. And then in Alaska, we have the unique situation where we only have one designated piece of land that belongs to a particular group of indigenous people, Metlakatla. And, you know, then the state is kind of divided up into native corporations, but really no other tribes having designated land. So the sense of what exactly, in what sense are those tribes a government without a connectedness to a land in a sense of a tribe in another lower 48 state that's very connected to a piece of land?
And that's an excellent question, and one that I can very honestly say my colleagues in the lower 48 who are practicing Indian law attorneys struggle with, because they're very much familiar with the model employed in the lower 48. And, you know, the answer here is a unique one. But governments, and I'll say just governments generally, this isn't peculiar or unique just to tribal government. Governments are entities that can exercise two forms of power, or power over two things. They can exercise sovereignty over a place, and they can exercise sovereignty over people. And here in Alaska, with the unique and one-of-a-kind institutions that we have tribal governments that do not, by and large, exercise sovereignty over a place. But we do, and as confirmed by many court opinions, by federal laws and state laws, is that we have tribes who exercise sovereignty or may exercise sovereignty over people. And we see that tribal governments, and which continue to exist after the Settlement Act, that existed before the Settlement Act, they perhaps do not have a land base, but they do have a citizenry to whom they are accountable, to that elects them to govern, and the exercise of sovereignty over a people continues, even with or absent of that land base that we see, you know, is easily pointed to in the lower 48 context with the creation and the boundary lines of reservation or Indian country.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Newman. Thank you for presenting before the committee today and for your time this morning. We will now turn to Elizabeth Seglick-Hensley. Ms. Hensley's law practice focuses on meeting the unique legal needs of Alaska Native corporations, tribes, and tribal nonprofits. Ms. Hensley, please put your name and affiliation on the record and begin your presentation.
Good morning, in Inupiaq. My name is Elizabeth Seglick-Hensley. I'm with the law firm Wendy Bennett, and I'm just so happy to hear you this morning. Well, it was great to hear Matt's presentation, and I'm always impressed by his command of the law on tribal matters. So I won't duplicate what he said, so I'll sort of go on the fly here, since we all didn't gather before the hearing to figure out who was saying what. So I'll just start by saying the state does have some pretty fabulous policy on the books in terms of supporting the government-to-government relationship between tribes and the state, and consultation going back to 2000 with Governor Knowles' administrative order number 186 and followed up by the 2001 Millennium Agreement between the state and tribes. The 2017 Attorney General opinion that AG Lindema issued, recognizing or just establishing that the state understands that there are federally recognized tribes in Alaska, that the state itself recognizes the tribes, and that they're separate sovereigns, excuse me, with inherent sovereignty and subject matter jurisdiction over certain matters. And then the 2018 Administrative Order number 300 stated that it is the policy of the state to recognize Alaska tribes' sovereignty by interacting and engaging with Alaska tribes on a government-to-government basis. So various administrations over the past 19 years or so have done some work to ensure that consultation would happen between the state and tribes. Because why not have the right people in the room at the right time to talk about things of mutual concern. So interestingly enough, in the broader legal context, consultation as is practiced in the United States is a slightly lesser standard than the gold standard established by the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The UN, I'll call it the UN DRIP. So the UN DRIP, which many of you are probably familiar with, sets the gold standard for state interactions with indigenous peoples. And it requires consultation and cooperation in good faith with the indigenous peoples concerned through their own representative institutions in order to obtain the tribe's free, prior, and informed consent before adopting and implementing things that will impact the tribe. So that free, prior, and informed consent element of the UN declaration is the gold standard. As we've seen consultation in the United States, it typically doesn't have consent on the part of the tribe as the desired outcome. It often is a process, and consultation is something that will happen in order to ensure that tribal considerations are taken into account, but it doesn't tend to require consent. So that's a really big difference between what the gold standard is and what we do. And the UNDRIP has various articles, and it clarifies where free, prior, and informed consent should happen. And that includes, you know, the adoption of legislation or administrative policies that affect Indigenous peoples, and then other things like the undertaking of projects that affect Indigenous peoples' rights to land, territory, resources, etc. So I wanted to share that just to provide some context on what people and tribes in Alaska may be asking for in the kind of United States context versus a global context where free, prior, and informed consent is mandated. So I say that not to say that the tribal consultation that folks are implementing and seek to implement in the state of Alaska is not a positive thing. It is a very positive thing. It's a good business decision. It gets the right people in the right room together around a table, or maybe walking on the land if people are, you know, out in the communities, and making sure that tribal citizens their needs will be served through whatever action is being contemplated. There are examples of where tribal consultation only makes sense. I'll give you a few, and there's a million, but just to focus on a few in the interest of time. The Violence Against Women Act requires the state to enforce tribal protection orders as if it were the order of the enforcing state. And protection orders are defined as any order issued for the purpose of preventing violent or threatening acts or harassment against sexual violence or contact or communication with or physical proximity to another person, or for the protection of victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, dating violence, or stalking. I know your committee just did some heavy work around missing and murdered Indigenous women, and I know that that's something that has been on your mind. I've seen some pictures on Facebook and such of, you know, the work that your committee has been doing, and I commend you for that. And I think people may be asking, you know, what can we do to prevent murder from being the number three killer of Native women, such as myself. So the VAWA, the Violence Against Women Act, is a tool for us. And how can you take advantage of VAWA and implement it, this section that I just read to you, without consultation? How can the state implement a program of enforcing tribal protection orders if the state and the tribe don't consult and don't communicate about what that looks like and how to make it successful and how to ensure our women are safe through VAWA? So that's one arena where kind of boots on the ground tribal consultation is critical. Another example is hunting and fishing. We know that hunting and fishing is a subject matter that people feel very passionately about, since it carries with it profound physical, cultural, and spiritual components. Many of our cultures around the state don't see fish and game and birds as resources to be allocated in many communities, they're relatives. So you know that tremendous amounts of conflict arise around fish and game allocations. So if we know that there's an area that is rife with conflict, what can we do about it? Well, one thing we can do is get around the table and consult. The state and tribe can sit down as governments and say, how are we going to do this better? How are we going to make sure that people can hunt and fish without feeling like criminals? And how can we make a system where people understand the regulations and where hunters are not confused because there is such a kind of broad array of regulations that are extremely hard to follow. So that's another area where tribal consultation could really do some good things for tribal citizens who are also Alaska residents. And there are some pilots in place where tribes, the state, and the federal government sit down and have signed agreements where they're going to work together to cooperatively manage fish, for example, out on the coast of Quim, the Yukon. And these are ways that people that we can really better serve the people of the state. So I think I've spoken long enough, but I just really want to thank you for inviting me to testify today and share some of my perspective on tribal consultation. And I'm happy to take any questions if you have any.
Are there any questions, Representative Kopp?
Thank you, Ms. Hensley, for coming to the committee today. Question I have, how would you see a good state tribal consultation process preventing the issue we had in 2013 or 14 when we had a very low run of kings on the Kuskokwim and families that needed to needed those kings? Basically, it was a substantial portion of their subsistence lifestyle, and even though the fishery was closed, they went and took some, and then the administration went and wrote a whole bunch of misdemeanor tickets for fishing in those waters, and it was just a complete debacle. And and I can't remember the exact year, so forgive me, I probably have the date wrong, but I remember it happening. And do you have any comment on how since you mentioned working hunting and fishing issues out, how that type of consultation could head off a problem like that, where you have a state, a regulatory body, fish and game, managing a fishery, running in direct conflict with traditional use that and ended up where, like you said, one group of people can be treated as a criminal for trying to maintain a traditional use during a time of low returns.
Thank you for your question. And through the chair, Representative Kopp, that's exactly where you want to see tribal consultation happen. And we run into those issues around the state periodically where there's a shortage of a resource and people still need to eat, and there's maybe conflicting information sometimes about, how healthy is the stock, how accurate are the counts, etc. And sometimes people will make the choice to continue to harvest, and sometimes they won't. And so those types of situations are exactly where, when the state sees that there's the stock, they're concerned about the population, you would want the state to call the tribes and say, hey, our numbers are showing that this population's down. Can we consult? Can we meet about this and figure out how we're going to partner to ensure that the stock is healthy and ensure that people get the food that they need? And we've seen on a couple of the different rivers communities take some really significant measures when they were concerned about stuff and impose moratoriums on fishing themselves through their tribes. And we've seen that happen, and then we've seen, so it was not, you know, a federal agency or a state agency coming and saying you need to stop fishing, but the tribes themselves saying, you know, we practice a sustainable fishery and we need to stop fishing for now until we can get a handle on the health of our fishery. And so I love that you brought this issue forward, because this is exactly the time when you would want that phone call to be placed and for people to get together.
Thank you. I know there's other examples, but that one stood out in my mind as a deeply troubling circumstance that I think most people in the state that were aware of that felt like there was a significant injustice that had occurred, but there seemed to be a lack of understanding of how to move forward. So my guess, I don't know, is that there probably wasn't much state tribal consultation at that time.
I think we've seen that when people came to the table, people were able, at least, you know, around the Kuskokwim when that fishery crashed, people came to the table, they hammered out an agreement for cooperative management and have been implementing it. I don't think it's an easy thing, but I think that people have been trying to stay the course and work together. And people have really different perspectives on those types of things, like a misdemeanor from, you know, the people who were fishing probably had a wildly different perspective from the enforcement officer who gave them the ticket. So it's like, how do we getting to the table to ensure all those perspectives are shared before people get, you know, penalized or fish when they're not supposed to, is a really beneficial thing to do. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Ms. Hensley, can you answer, does lack of state law requiring consultation preclude the state from engaging in tribal consultation?
Chair Zolkowski, absolutely not. There's no, you don't need a law that says you have to consult. It is something inherent in a sovereign entity. The state's a sovereign, the tribes are sovereigns, they can consult. There's nothing that precludes that in the state constitution or any state laws. It is 100% permissible. I think that had there been a constitutional problem, I don't believe Governor Noel and his administration and his legal advisors would have put in place the Millennium Agreement. I don't think Attorney General Donna Lindema would have issued an opinion that conflicted with the state constitution or state law. I don't think Governor Walker's Administrative Order Number 300 would have been put in place mandating government-to-government consultation. Governor Walker himself is an attorney, and he had a whole fleet of lawyers advising him. I don't imagine he would have done something in direct conflict with our state constitution or laws.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Hensley, for your presentation this morning and for the work that you do in our state and just making time to speak with us. We will now hear from Natasha Singh, General Counsel for Tanana Chiefs Conference, who also serves as the co-lead negotiator for Alaska's Tribal Health Compact. Ms. Singh, if you could put your name and affiliation on the record and begin your presentation.
Hi, Good morning, Natasha Singh, General Counsel for Tanana Chiefs Conference. Thank you for this invitation, Chair Sokolsky. I just like to thank the others testifying today. Really laid the groundwork for what we are talking about. I specifically was asked to talk about our relationship with Indian Health Service and how and the Health and Human Services Department and how that plays out in Alaska and how our consultation, negotiations, and work groups with Indian Health Service plays out. But I also have some comments on the non-health discussion as well that occurred just now. Just to lay some background for our relationship with Indian Health Service, really the only policy in the history of the country that has been successful is tribal self-determination. And that's recognizing that Native people know best how to solve their own problems and how to implement programs in their communities. And this was championed by President Nixon and a Republican Congress. This tribal self-determination has historically been bipartisan, and since the federal law was first enacted, the Indian Self-Determination Act, it has really developed over the decades. And that's where you get where we are today with the Alaska tribe fully taking over the services provided to the tribe by the Indian Health Service. So in Alaska, the tribes were offered a demonstration project, and rather than the tribes competing against each other in the 90s, we decided to come under one demonstration, so all tribes were under one contract with the federal government. This has really benefited us in the long run, because we speak with one unified voice with the Indian Health Service. And basically, we've taken over all services, and annually we're able to negotiate our contract, which really, in federal terms, is a compact. But really, it comes up to an agreement where we say, yes, Indian Health Service, we know what's best for our people. You don't know what's best. We do. And we're going to negotiate with you on how we take over the authorities and responsibilities to do that. We are in our responsibilities taking over the contract. We follow consultation policy both with the Indian Health Service and the HHS department, which both have separate consultation policies. We also have negotiation rules, and then we have work group, which isn't necessarily a consultation, but it kind of gets the discussion going. A work group can trigger a formal consultation if necessary. So I think what I'd like to tell the committee is, for what we see in our experience on the federal side, the best consultations occur with starting with a consultation policy, and the policy should be, of course, written out with both the state and the tribe working on the purposes and the policy itself. And it's important to revisit the policy, even if it's working, for improvements. And just this week, we see HHS revisiting their tribal consultation policy. And we have a lot of improvements, suggestions on the tribal side to do that. Within the consultation policy, you can explicitly state the purpose. And in reviewing consultation policies for different agencies in preparation for this discussion, what stands out is really a goal of eliminating health and human services disparities for Native people. And I think that's what the state should focus on as well, and a real reason why you'd want to have a formal tribal consultation policy outside of the regular public comment, because whether we like it or not, Native people face extreme disparities, whether it be education, health care, child protection, and we, because of these disparities, the state should be really hyper-focused on our populations, because they should be wanting to fix these issues and asking us, again, how they can partner with us to fix the issues. That's how consultation works with IHS and the department. Negotiations is a little different. Really, we're sitting down with Indian Health Service annually, and we're negotiating our contract language. We're negotiating how funding is distributed. And it's a very important process for our relationship, as basically Indian Health Service has hired us, but they have, you know, Congress mandated that they hire us to carry out their services, and we're able to negotiate with them the language on just how to do that. Each year we sit down for the equivalent of 2 weeks and hammer out the language. In addition to negotiations and consultation, we also have work groups on a variety of issues. We have our IT work group, our facilities work group. Budget formulation is a very important work group between tribes and Indian Health Service, where we really get to the details of how the department or how the agency will request funding from Congress. And again, this is in recognition of the health disparities in Indian country. And the agency gives a lot of weight to what the tribes say is needed to improve these disparities. I think this kind of budget formulation work group would be very helpful with the state of Alaska as we consider our budget crisis. We also have specific work groups for anything a statute might require and the agency would like guidance on how to implement. And if, like for instance, the facilities work group, if they come up with an issue where the discussion triggers a disagreement, we can't move beyond, the work group itself can't get beyond an issue, then they'll actually recommend a formal consultation where tribes will submit formal comments for the record, and the Indian Health Service will formally review them. And in their report, they'll describe how they actually considered each comment in creating a solution to the problem or a new regulation or what have you. And that really makes our comments meaningful when the when the state or when the agency has to respond directly to those comments. I think that's it for health. If there's any questions, but I also have just a little bit of comments on how Canada Chiefs Conference has experienced some informal consultation in the with past administrations.
Ms. Singh, you described that the best consultations begin with conversations about a consultation policy, and you described what might be included in that policy as including the purpose and goals. Are there any other aspects of consultation policy that would be helpful for us to know and understand?
Sure. So I thought it was helpful how the consultation procedures will also happen, because this can be very difficult in Alaska, actually implementing this because of the amount of our tribes, the great amount of our tribes, and it sometimes is difficult to actually effectively communicate with such a large group. So if you lay out exactly the consultation procedures, including how a tribe will receive notice and the communication, I think that will be very important for a successful policy. Also, just the responsibilities on specific agencies or whoever you're working with, I think that's also important.
Thank you. In a follow-up question, you had suggested that just as an example, the Tribal Health Compact, that there are negotiation rules that are set out between both parties. Can you just describe briefly, and it doesn't have to be in explicit detail, but just what some of that, what some of those agreements are at the front end between both parties?
Sure. So the rules have developed over time to kind of address bumps in the road of our negotiations. So the rules are organic. They're continually being updated each year. After negotiations, we'll meet with the agency, the tribes and the agency will meet to talk about what went well, what didn't work, and kind of amend the rules. The rules set out a purpose, really describing the foundation of negotiations is based on good faith, trust, and the government-to-government relationship. It sets out the roles of each player in the negotiation, including the lead negotiators for both the agency and the tribe. It describes how a tribe will submit a negotiation package. It sets out deadlines for language, which we've seen, if we don't stick to strict deadlines, the gray area causes a lot of angst between the parties. It sets out other rules in the process of negotiations and timeline. And it sets out the rules for our funding tables, which get pretty highly technical in how funding is distributed.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay, so TCC has had a lot of experience with various agents, state departments in the past, and we've seen our, really the Office of Children's Services really improve when it has really grabbed hold of this idea of Native tribal self-determination is what will work best for Native people to to improve child protection disparities. I think that's the best example of that. And while I'm not sure if OCS has a formal tribal consultation policy, in the past, we've seen when they've taken discussions with tribes very seriously and really really considered tribal comments and really implemented tribal comments throughout the agency's, throughout the department's policies. Also, Liz Hensley was bringing up the VAWA issue, and we actually just last week, Tanana Chiefs Conference, have met with Commissioner Price on issues of enforcing VAWA protection orders that we've had in our region. We met with some officers from the state troopers as well, and really the informal discussion really informed both sides of situations, and we agreed that we're going to have these regular meetings with her and Tanana Chiefs Conference going forward, because the discussion itself just helped so much, and I just really appreciate Commissioner Price for that. And I hope, you know, the other commissioners will kind of take her lead in reaching out and working with tribes, but hasn't been always the case in past administrations. Unless you have a formal consultation policy which requires these commissioners to meet with us and really consider our comments, it might not happen. And we saw this in past administrations where sometimes the department wouldn't even agree to meet with us, or when they did, they might not be able to really take our comments seriously. We've also had a crisis of king salmon on the Yukon River, and it's a very difficult river to manage. One of the most challenging rivers in the entire nation to manage fisheries, because there's just so many rivers, and it covers so much. The watershed just covers so much area. When we had the actual commissioner out in our areas during fishing on the ground and the Yukon River manager, only then were they able to have the proper discussion with our communities, and we were able to reach all of our communities on the Yukon River recently. And with the commissioner and the agency leaders, ADF&G leaders, and only then were they able to really get the feedback they needed to actually change the way the Yukon River was managed, and we saw that. And I'd like to just note that Commissioner Douglas Vincent Lang has agreed to continue these visits this summer, so we really look forward to that. Just in closing, I'd just like to say tribal consultation really is good government. While you have to put comments within the state, a tribal consultation policy would actually recognize that we have 200 tribes within the state. These tribes have the same goals that the state does. We're trying to improve the health of our communities and, you know, reverse these disparities that we face. Alaska Native people make up almost 20% of the state, and the tribal consultation policy would really recognize that we are special. We are a special population. So thank you for your time.
Thank you for your presentation before the committee this morning and all the work that you do on behalf of Alaska and our tribal health system, Ms. Singh.
Thank you for all the work you all are doing, and good morning to my sister Grace. Hello.
We will now turn to hear from the Alaska Federation of Natives Committee on the Advancement of Alaska Natives, also known as CAN. Patrick Anderson is the CEO for RURALCAP and sits on the AFN CAN committee. I know, Mr. Anderson, that you have a long career in tribal nonprofits and tribal management. If you could begin by putting your name and affiliation on the record and begin your presentation.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Patrick Anderson. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of RURALCAP, and as you stated, a member of the Council for the Advancement of Alaska Natives. My last time serving on that, we were known as the Human Resource Committee. I've also served in a variety of capacities in Indian Country, including elected and appointed officials. I've been involved in consultations. The Indian Child Welfare Act was on the table in 1972 when I was a board member of the Association on American Indian Affairs. I got to know the giants in Indian law at the time. But today, what I would like to talk to you about is the value of having an actual discussion with tribes. As an appointed official in Washington State as a tribal health director, I received under the rules of diplomacy for Indian Country, under the Washington State consultation policy, the authority to speak on behalf of the tribe. The protocols that we followed were that were the chairman present, the chairman spoke. If the vice chair or a council member were there, they had priority. When it came to health matters, as the tribal health director, I was the official representative for the Makah Nation and able to speak to all matters. We actually had a very structured process. The Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board was in many respects the embassy. They became the health experts. They applied for grants on behalf of the 32 tribes in Washington State. They did the research. The leadership, of which I was an alternate, consisted of tribally appointed officials who directed the executive director of the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board to work in very complex and interrelated, interdependent matters. The last initiative that I was working on while there happened to be the Section 1115 Medicaid waiver that Washington State had received. And it ended up being a process that involved regular hospitals, healthcare institutions, it involved county governments, and it involved a whole variety of interrelated entities that were dealing with the issues of the heavy usage of Medicaid patients, of Medicaid, and it was basically around addressing needs on a coordinated care basis. I took one of the first Indian law courses ever offered. Dr. Renard Strickland at the University of New Mexico offered that. As I said, I was involved in the policy setting of the Indian Child Welfare Act. That Indian Child Welfare Act has been in place for longer than I've been a lawyer. I've been a member of the bar for 40 years in Alaska now. It's incredibly complex, and every year we find out more about why our children do not thrive. Just recently, under the Trump administration, they dealt with the issue of foster care. It was a bipartisan effort. The goal is to keep foster children in stable families, preferably relatives. In 45 years of conversation, we've advanced our knowledge a lot, but it's because we've had that conversation. A number of years ago, I was on the Tribal Law and Order Commission with the heavy hitters in law in the state of Alaska, the U.S. Attorney, the Attorney General, prominent lawyers, members of the Alaska Native community, and we were again dealing with the Indian Child Welfare Act. There is a lot of research engaged, and to have conversations about children is incredibly complex. A number of years ago, I wrote resolution for Representative Tarr to introduce dealing with adverse childhood experiences. That is a topic that emerged in 1998, and yet in Washington State it advanced very quickly, and in the state of Alaska not as quickly. It deals with childhood acquired trauma. In Washington State, they had a very active effort. And they were a little bit more advanced than we are as a result of having conversations that brought to light the complex issues. I am a fan of Dr. Edgar Schein, who is a professor at the Sloan School at MIT. He wrote about a concept called humble inquiry. In healthcare, what we realized is that when people slide into chronic disease, the most important attribute that we can have with them is a relationship of trust and of their belief that our medical providers have their best interests at heart. And in that context, the concept of motivational interviewing was coined, and the practice of it began. It actually started off in behavioral health. Motivational interviewing is the act of asking about the best interests of the individual that you're speaking to. When you form a relationship with a physician, which unfortunately we don't have the opportunity to do as much today, you tend to trust that individual more. You as representatives spend time sometimes in heated debate and intense conversation and discussion, and yet at the end of the day, if you've done your job correctly, you can have a relationship with each other and find out more so that you are able to understand the motivations that you come in with and perhaps have discussions about how we can collectively come to the point where we actually can do something about the incredibly complex relationships that we have. And Dr. Schein changed his concept of motivational interviewing and called it humble inquiry. And he talks about a multitude of different kinds of inquiry. As a former practicing lawyer, one of the inquiries that we did was cross-examination. It doesn't make anyone feel good to be cross-examined, to be questioned. Humble inquiry is what I believe tribal consultation should be all about. It is forming the relationships after successive leadership changes in government, including tribal governments, but having a foundation where you have discussed these difficult issues, you've come up with a structure similar to what the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board has come up with, where you can discuss them without anger, without animosity, with an understanding of the limited resources that are available, and advance your knowledge. I know I come at it a little differently than some of my tribal members do. I've been involved in consultation. One issue that we tried to convince the Indian Health Service to do was to move away from the old RPMS electronic health record. And yet during ARA, the leadership there decided to put well over $100 million into revising the old RPMS platform. Today I read that, similar to the Veterans Administration, that those platforms don't serve the needs of their customers and patients. So what we had advocated for back then, which was to go to a commercial platform, is now happening. Humble inquiry takes you away from the point where you believe that you know the best answer for solving a very complex problem. I don't. I have lots of conversations with my staff on how we address some of the intractable issues that we experience, high levels of alcohol addiction, high levels of cocaine addiction. We have a very high rate of sexual violence. We have a very high rate of children's violence. To have a platform to discuss those without wagging fingers and saying it's your fault, how can we find solutions, is a great approach. And that's where I believe tribal consultation can take us. The humble inquiry actually means that you acknowledge that you have gaps in what you know. It takes great self-introspection. It takes a conversation. Consultation goes both ways, but the start is that we are interested in your point of view. As the executive director of two tribal organizations and one non-tribal organization over the last 15 years, I've been involved in a lot of the battles. In addition, I've served as parliamentarian for the Alaska Federation of Natives, where policy resolutions are made, and for the National Congress of American Indians, again, where resolutions from tribal representatives are introduced. They're well thought out. When we go into Congress, we get listened to. We don't always get listened to in consultation, but that just depends on the individual and their orientation. And doing so, we've been able to address a lot of problems. The Village Public Safety Officer program I administered for a number of years. There are great difficulties in that program, but it was actually one of the very few presences of police authority in a community, and a sense that in many places actually helps the community feel a little bit safe. That's connected to trauma. That's also connected to a lot of negative issues that occur. And to have a forum where tribal leadership can come in and in the context of a caring administration actually be heard, and then to have the structure set up outside consultation to be able to look into and discuss resolution of those issues is wonderful. Right now, Rural CAP is in 60 different villages. It's very difficult. And I understand what prior testimony said about getting 229 tribes together. But what I saw in Washington State is that they did come together and have the discussions framed by people who were very knowledgeable, essential to what our diplomats do today. Ambassadors conduct a lot of our formal protocols, and then the state service, actually, the diplomatic corps, are the ones who engage in attempting to problem solve, and then they bring it back up. It'd be wonderful to have that process, Madam Chair. I know you have a hard deadline. I just encourage you to think about humble inquiry on the part of the state. It's not a mandate. It is something that comes from the heart that you really want to talk about and find solutions to these incredibly complex problems that we face with the people who face those problems on a daily basis. So thank you very much.
Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Anderson, I really appreciate your presentation and also the mission and work of Rural CAP, and just learned a lot more about your very rich history and service to the state on a variety of levels. I'm particularly interested in your time. You said you spent with the VPSO program. That's an area of particular interest to a number of us, and we may be calling on you in the future for your thoughts on that.
I would absolutely like to share those. It's very difficult in a community where everyone is related to have someone there addressing negative behaviors. That's a complex area, and as you well know as representatives, we have a huge corrections budget. We don't manage relationships, negative relationships, very well, and I'll be happy to discuss my experience at some point in the future.
Mr. Anderson, we really appreciate your time with us this morning. I just want to state that your comments about humble inquiry and making sure that we're asking about the best interests of the individuals in which we're speaking with really resonated, particularly. I know that as a state, we always want to make sure that the federal government asks the state what is in our best interest, and it seems appropriate to be able to extend that same type of relationship with local governments and federally recognized tribes in our state, in my opinion. We know that you're here to do other work and advocacy in the building, and that you accepted the invitation to join us this morning on a brief time frame, and so we really appreciate your thorough presentation this morning, so thank you.
And thank you, Madam Chair. It's real important that the Native community have a voice. But it's real important for the state as well. I served on the Sea Alaska Corporation Board of Directors for years. I'm very familiar and have represented ANCSA corporations. The billions of dollars in revenue that they bring to the total gross product for the state of Alaska is critical and important, and it depends on the sovereign relationships that Alaska tribes have with the federal government. The Indian Health Service the same way. Huge dollar amounts being brought into the state of Alaska, and it's a benefit to the state to nurture that relationship and try to grow it, because I believe it can be grown. So thank you very much. I appreciate this opportunity, and thank you for what you do.
That concludes our presentation on state and tribal consultation opportunities in Alaska. Please be advised that our committee will not be meeting this Thursday, May 9th. Enjoy sleeping in. I know I will, I hope. The time is 9:52 a.m., and this House Special Committee on Tribal Affairs is now adjourned.